Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are opening up the hood of the economy to look at, well, the engine itself. We're tackling a topic that sounds incredibly intimidating. Chapter 5, Dynamic Competitive Equilibrium.
It is a mouthful.
It is. And usually, you know, when people hear equilibrium, they think of that static chart from Econ 101. You know the one. Supply crosses demand, X marks the spot, everyone goes home. But the real world moves. It has time, it has risk, and most importantly, it has mortality.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I mean, if basic supply and demand is a photograph, dynamic competitive equilibrium is the whole movie. It's the source code, really, for how economists think about the passage of time. We're going to take this stack of dense macroeconomic theory and figure out how we get from the chaos of millions of individual decisions today to a coherent story about tomorrow.
And that's our mission. To decode how economists model all this chaos. But before we jump in, the source material makes a really specific assumption right at the start. We are operating in a world of perfect competition.
Which, let's be honest, is a benchmark. We know real firms have power, that markets have friction, but you need that perfect baseline to measure the messiness against. So in this framework, there's no coercion. Prices just adjust until markets clear. It's the invisible hand, but, and this is crucial, it's an invisible hand that stretches across time.
Okay, so here's our roadmap. The text lays out three distinct ways to mathematically model this movie. We have the arrow-to-brew model, which is sort of the Big Bang approach.
Right.
Then there's sequential equilibrium, which is the day-by-day reality we all actually live in.
Yeah.
Then we have recursive equilibrium, which is how a computer programmer would solve it.
And then the plot twist. We introduce the one thing that kind of breaks all the math. Death. We'll get to the overlapping generations model and why the fact that we aren't immortal changes, well, the price of everything.
Let's start with part one, then. The arrow-to-brew equilibrium. The source uses a framework here that is elegant on paper, but practically insane. Imagine that the moment you're born, let's call it time zero, you sign a contract for every single thing you will ever do for the rest of your life.
It's a wild concept, isn't it? Hmm. In an arrow-to-brew world, markets for all future dates open at once. So you're not just buying a coffee for today. You are standing at time zero, buying a contract that delivers one coffee on, say, January 18th, 2030. You trade your entire lifetime right there at the starting line.
So I'm planning my 80th birthday party while I'm still in the cradle. How do we even determine the price? If a coffee is $5 today, is it $5 in that 2030 contract?
Almost certainly not. There are two main gears turning here. First, you have the discount factor, beta. Humans are impatient. You'd rather have a coffee today than in 10 years, right?
And of course.
So future goods are naturally cheaper at time zero. The text normalizes the price of today's good, the numerator, to one, and everything else is discounted from there.
Right, that's standard discounting. But the text mentions a second factor, something tied to scarcity.
Exactly. This is where the general equilibrium part kicks in. The price also depends on the aggregate endowment, how much stuff exists in the economy in any given year. So if the economy crashes in 2030 and goods are scarce, the marginal utility of that coffee just skyrockets.
Everyone is desperate.
Everyone is desperate. So the arrow-to-brew price for a 2030 good will be higher to reflect that.
So a future price signals both our impatience and the expected scarcity of goods. That makes sense. And this leads to one of the most important ideas in the chapter, consumption smoothing.
This is the economic equivalent of a smooth ride. And the model shows that what consumers really want is to keep their marginal utility constant. So even if your personal income is volatile, you know, a freelancer with good years and bad years, your consumption shouldn't look like that. In this time zero market, you effectively buy insurance. You sell the extra from your good years to fund your bad years.
So even if my income is a roller coaster, my lifestyle is a flat road.
If the aggregate economy is stable, yes. But the text adds a really crucial detail about wealth inequality here. In this model, consumption growth is the same for everyone. We're all on the same smooth path. But the level of that path, whether you're eating steak or ramen, that differs based on initial wealth.
And wealth here isn't just about how much stuff you have, is it?
No, and this is a really profound point. Wealth is about timing. If you have a skill that pays out when everyone else is broke, say you're a bankruptcy lawyer in a recession, the market values your endowment more. You're bringing resources to the table when they are most scarce. That makes you wealthier in the model.
That is a key insight. Value is relative. But let's be real, I did not sign a contract at birth for my coffee this morning.
I hope not.
I just walked into a shop and tapped my card.
Which brings us to part two, living in reality, or as the text calls it, sequential equilibrium.
Right. The date LO idea is It's an abstraction. Sequential equilibrium describes how we actually live. We trade period by period. We have a budget constraint every single day. But if I only have a budget for today, how do I smooth my consumption? If I make $0 today, I still need to eat.
That is where assets come in. In the sequential model, to link Tuesday to Wednesday, you need a bridge. That bridge is borrowing or saving. If you want to consume more than you earn today, you borrow. That's holding negative assets. If you earn more, you save positive assets.
But there's a catch. The text mentions a rule with a very specific name, the no Ponzi game condition. It sounds like a fraud warning, but here it's a mathematical constraint.
And it is vital. Without it, you could just borrow money to pay off old debt, then borrow more to pay off that debt, and just do that forever.
Live like a king and never pay the piper.
Exactly. The no Ponzi constraint ensures that in the long run, your debt can't grow faster than the interest rate. Eventually, you have to settle up.
So we have these two models, one where we buy everything at birth, one where we trade daily. The big question is, do they end up in different places?
And this is the big reveal of the chapter. They don't.
Wait, really?
They yield the exact same allocations. The quantity of bread you eat in 2030 is identical in both models. The relative prices are identical. The text explains that the interest rate term, 1 over 1 plus R, in the sequential model is, well, it's just the ratio of the heir to brew prices.
So it's two different mathematical languages describing the exact same economic reality.
Precisely. Which is reassuring because it means the simpler model, heir to brew, is actually a valid tool for prediction, even if it feels totally unrealistic.
Okay, moving on. Part three. Up until now, we've been talking about endowments like manna from heaven. But in the real world, we have to actually make stuff. We need production.
This adds a new layer. Now, we don't just have consumers, we have firms. The text introduces the representative firm.
And is this a monopoly?
No, that's a common confusion. The representative firm is just a convenient fiction. We assume thousands of identical firms, so we can just model them as one big one. And this firm is actually simpler than the consumer because it doesn't really plan for the future. The firm just maximizes profit moment to moment, revenue minus cost. It hires labor until wage equals productivity. It's very transactional.
But for the household, it's not just about spending money. It's about earning it. And that brings us to the labor supply puzzle. This trade-off, work gives me income, but leisure gives me joy.
Right. And this brings up a huge debate in macroeconomics. If wages go up, do you work more or do you work less?
Intuitively, I'd say more. If you pay me double, I'm clocking in extra hours.
That's the substitution effect. Leisure becomes more expensive because you're losing more money by not working. But there's also the income effect. If you get paid double, you feel richer. And rich people like to, you know, consume leisure. They take vacations.
So the two effects are fighting each other. One says work more. The other says relax, you're rich.
Exactly. And the text points out that with a specific kind of utility log utility, these two effects can cancel each other out perfectly. It helps explain why, in the data, high-skilled people who earn massive hourly wages don't necessarily work 100-hour weeks. They work about the same hours as everyone else. The effects wash out.
That explains so much. Okay, yeah. Before we move on, we have to talk about investing. The firm uses capital. Where does that decision come from?
That comes from the neoclassical growth model. We don't just eat our output. We invest some of it. We build factories, machines. And that decision is governed by the Euler equation. It's a balancing act. The cost of investing today, giving up that consumption, has to equal the discounted return you get tomorrow.
So every time a business builds a factory, they're betting that future production will outweigh the pain of spending that money today.
Correct. And in equilibrium, that return determines the interest rate for the whole economy.
Now we pivot to the third method. We've done the timeline. We've done the daily trade. Now we need to think like a computer programmer. This is recursive equilibrium.
This is a huge shift in perspective. Instead of thinking in timelines, year one, year two, year three, you think in states.
States.
A state is just a snapshot of the economy right now. The text uses a capital K for the aggregate capital in the whole economy and a lowercase k for your individual capital. So you don't look at the calendar. You look at the state variables and you say, okay, I have this much. The world has that much. Based on this state, what is my move?
So it's a rule book.
Yes, it's called a policy function. It's a function that tells you exactly how much to save given the current situation. You don't have a plan for 2030. You have a rule for whenever I find myself here, I do this.
And what makes it an equilibrium?
Consistency. That's the key word. As an individual, you have a belief about how the aggregate economy moves. In recursive equilibrium, your belief about the world has to match what actually happens when everyone follows their policy functions.
So if I assume the economy is going to grow by 2% and I act on that and everyone else does too, the result better actually be 2% growth.
Exactly. If the math doesn't close the loop, it's not an equilibrium. The reason economists love this method dynamic programming is that it solves the problem of infinite time. You just solve for the functions.
That sounds incredibly efficient. But speaking of eternity, we have a problem. These models so far assume dynasties, that families live forever. In part 5, the text introduces the plot twist, overlapping generations, the OG model.
This is where things get really spicy. The OG model acknowledges a fundamental biological fact. People die.
Big if true.
And not only do they die, new people are born. You have cohorts, the young who work and the old who are retired. And here's the friction. You can't trade with the unborn and you can't trade with the dead.
That seems like a pretty hard constraint. It effectively breaks the market, doesn't it?
It creates huge problems. Mm. In the basic version of this model where there's no money or assets, you are an autarky.
Meaning you're on your own.
Completely. The young eat what they earn. The old eat what they have. They can't trade. The young want to save for retirement, but there's no one to sell their goods to who can pay them back in the future.
And this leads to a result that the source describes as basically impossible in the other models.
Negative real interest rates.
This just blew my mind. How does that happen?
Well, think about it. If you earn a huge amount when you're young, but you know you'll have zero income when you're old, you are desperate to move resources to the future.
You're desperate to save.
But if the market mechanisms are broken, the price of future goods just skyrockets.
So I'm so desperate to have a sandwich when I'm 80 that I'd be willing to give up 5 sandwiches today just to guarantee that one sandwich then.
Exactly that. Right. And that implies a negative interest rate. In a dynastic model, this never happens because you just smooth consumption forever. But here, you're trapped.
And the text says this means the market is inefficient.
Yes. It's likely not Pareto optimal. This is one of the few times in standard economics where a government intervention can make everyone strictly better off.
Mm.
If the government forces the young to transfer money to the old, like a social security system, it solves the friction that the private market couldn't.
That is fascinating. So social security isn't just charity, it's solving a market failure caused by mortality.
Precisely. It allows the generations to trade through the government.
But wait, don't parents care about their kids? Doesn't that link the generations back together?
This brings us to the final section, bequests. And the text outlines 3 ways to model this.
Okay, lay them out for us.
First, there's random death or perpetual youth. This basically assumes people might die, but they might also live forever. It just mimics the dynastic model.
Okay, so that's mathematically cheating death. What's the second one?
Second, there is warm glow. This is impure altruism. This is when you give a bequest to your kid, not because you care about their happiness, but because the act of giving makes you feel good.
So it's, look at me, I'm such a generous parent.
Yes, it's behavioral. You get utility from the gift itself. Because that link is weak, it doesn't really solve the OG problems.
And the third?
Pure altruism. This is the game changer. This models the parent as caring about the child's actual utility function. I'm happy only if you're happy. And since your child cares about their child, and so on.
It relinks the chain.
It relinks the chain into a single infinite dynasty. If pure altruism exists, we are right back to the Aero de Bruijn results. The negative interest rates disappear, the market works again.
So the entire macroeconomic prediction for a country, whether interest rates are positive or negative, whether government debt matters, it all depends on whether parents actually care about their kids' happiness or just enjoy the feeling of writing a check.
That is the power of these models. A small change in how we define human motivation, warm glow versus pure altruism, completely flips the prediction.
Incredible. So let's wrap this up. We started with the Aero de Bruijn Big Bang contract, realize it's the same as trading day by day, turned it into computer code, and then broke the whole thing with mortality, only to maybe fix it again with love.
Or at least pure altruism. That's the journey. And the big takeaway, I think, is that equilibrium isn't a static thing. It's a dynamic breathing process where our expectations about the future determine the price of everything today.
And here's a final thought to leave you with, something that wasn't explicitly in the text, but just jumps out from that OG discussion. If the market can fail just because generations can't trade with each other, Are we currently living through a version of that negative interest rate psychology right now? With aging populations and smaller younger generations, are we seeing these frictions play out in real time in our bond markets?
That's a trillion-dollar question. If demographics are destiny, then the OG model might be the most important guidebook we have for the next 20 years.
Something to chew on. Thank you for taking this deep dive with us. We hope your own personal equilibrium is stable until next time.
Thanks for listening.